Good morning, good afternoon. Thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants have the lines open. The call today is being recorded. If you have any objections, please, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the meeting over to Terry Agnew. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 8th of July, 2014. On the call today, we have Holly Raich, Laura Jadid, Tatania Kremstova, Val Sherman, Sarah Wild, Justin Macy, James Bledel, Griffin Barnett, Graham Bunton, Steve Medelitz, Roy Belist, Kathy Kleiman, Chris Pelling, Stephanie Perrin, Michaela Nyland, Don Moody, Don Blumenthal, David Heasley, Jim Bykoff, Luke Sufer, Susan Kawaguchi, Darcy Southwell, Frank Malekic, and Lindsay Hamilton Reed. We have apologies from Susan Prosser, Osvaldo Nueva, and Brian Winterfelt. From staff, we have Glenn D. St. Jerry, Marika Konings, Mary Wong, Amy Bivens, and myself, Terry Agnew. I'd like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much. And Don, have we had you join yet? Don, we're not able to hear you.
All right, one more try.
There you are. Thank you, Don.
Okay. I love technology. Sorry about the delay. Looks like I wasn't the only one who had issues with the Adobe audio setup or mic setup. In any event, welcome back after the ICANN break. A number of us had a complete break, did post-ICANN vacations. I got back last night, hadn't been home after ICANN, so apologies if I get a little strange or a little off the wall, more off the wall than usual. We've also got a brutal storm here, so if I drop out, please just keep on going. In any event, I think we had a very productive meeting in London. It's, I think, the first time, for those of you who weren't there, first time I've ever seen applause after an ICANN workgroup session. Now, I don't know if that was the quality of the session or just the fact that we actually wrapped up 5 minutes early, which is also somewhat unexpected at these sessions. But 5 minutes early or not, it worked out, I think, very well. We had a good discussion around the table of ongoing issues. Basically, we went down preliminary conclusions that we had come to, had some discussions on some of them. But what I really was impressed with is that we had a good cross-section of people in the audience, including somebody who came over from Interpol after I put out a call when I was at a law enforcement meeting and was vocal. Had a number of vocal meaning not vociferous, just he did contribute. Had a number of other contributions from the audience, and I believe at least one new member as a result. Graham mentioned that to me. Maybe he can fill in details on who that was, and we'll check to see if she actually did sign up. That's a quick and dirty summary. Glad to have anybody else add any highlights or any points that you think are important. No, Luke, I already had my vacation planned long before I can. No law enforcement intimidation there at all. That's in the chat if people can read it. And I actually think we might have the person who signed up on the line, Lindsay Hamilton Reed, whose name I saw in chat here. So So I'll step back again and see if there are anything people want to add from what went on Wednesday morning. Okay. Seeing none, or whatever the phrase is, let's move on to agenda item 3. Okay. I thought it was there. We're roughly 6 months into our real work. I think it's fair to say didn't get into the process until January. So I think it's a good time to step back and see where we are. Our progress so far has been excellent. I really appreciate everybody's effort. I think roughly we're about done with 4 out of our 7 topics. We had a difficult one in the first half. I expect another difficult one in the second half, relay reveal. So that should even out. But here generally is how we've been going. It's on the screen there. And just want to see if anybody has comments or thoughts on things we need to your thoughts on where we are, things we need to revisit, adjust, consider. You know, as we've said all along, the templates have temporary conclusions. We will be revisiting all of them. So nothing is cast in stone yet. James?
Hi, Don. Thanks. James speaking for the transcript. And one topic that came out of London, both from the formal meeting and just sort of some casual conversations amongst working group members, is this idea of the scenario of what happens when an accredited privacy proxy service provider loses its accreditation, and what will happen to its customers and those privacy-protected domain names. And currently we have a fairly complex but I think tested process in place for when that happens for registrars. And I think one thing that we may unfortunately need to tackle as part of this work plan is developing a parallel process like that for privacy proxy services. So I just wanted to say that may, depending on how much heavy lifting there is involved there, that may affect this work plan. I think another option might be, and I'm just putting this out here as a proposal, would be to take it off the critical path and set up a sub-team to address specifically that issue of, or that scenario, and determine what happens when a service provider either voluntarily or involuntarily loses their accreditation, maintaining some continuity of service for those customers. So just putting that out there is something that might be a new item that we uncovered during London.
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that. It was kicked around and then brought up formally at the face-to-face meeting. Do you think it's appropriate to put it in with Category G, which generally deals with termination, but just another topic within that category, or should we try to bump it up?
So my understanding, and this is James speaking again, my understanding was that topic, termination, was specific to a domain name losing its terminating its its status. If it includes the broader termination of a service provider, then I think it would be appropriately included there.
No, I don't think it does. No, I think the current item G clearly doesn't include the issue you're talking about. I'm just trying to figure if there's a logical place where we could put it in. That's all.
We could expand that category, I guess, to encompass this. That would be one option.
Okay. Well, we're. Yeah, I think we need to consider that again, where to put it, and also James's idea of a subgroup to be looking at it. Yeah, I appreciate your mentioning that. We do have to. It's complex enough. You're right. It could have an effect on the timetable.
John, this is Marika. Can I comment on this specific point?
Yeah, I was definitely, yes. Then I'll get to Kathy.
So this is Marika, and I think it's a point I made as well during the meeting in London that, of course, part of this question is an operational aspect, which I think is the same way as it happens with the accreditation of registrars. It's not a policy question. So my suggestion was as part of the framework that staff is working on that takes into account the accreditation part, but our assumptions, of course, it also looks at what happens in de-accreditation scenarios, that maybe first you give some time to staff to indeed work that out and share that with the working group and see indeed if you then see if there are any policy aspects that would need to be considered as part of the de-accreditation process that would need to be addressed. But at this stage, I'm not sure how helpful it would be to start focusing on that without having an overview of the overall accreditation, de-accreditation framework that staff is working on. And Mary and I can take it back to our colleagues to see as well what their timeline is, at what stage they will be able to share some further information on that. And as I said, maybe at that stage it will become clear if there are still any policy issues that would need to be dealt with as part of the de-accreditation process. And as I said, you know, there are probably some experiences that they can share or have learned from how that happens in other scenarios. I think it's probably something where staff can do some initial work, and if they need it, that are further issues to consider, maybe then the category G could be an appropriate place where those issues can be considered further.
I appreciate that. We're certainly not going to focus on it immediately, or I think even in the next week or so. I think it would be useful to hear from staff, but I think you're right off the top. Inherently, I can see some policy issues that are going to be there. So certainly what staff's working on will help us frame things, but it's something that we're going to have to look at some point. Kathy?
Hi, Don. Can you hear me? Hello, everybody. It was great to see you in London. My point was not to follow up to James, but given that he's raised it, I think what you and he are saying is important, that we have to look at the special problems of a de-accreditation involving a proxy privacy service provider, and particularly the danger of revealing the underlying registrant data in a situation where it doesn't have to be revealed. So I'm with you. This may involve some special attention from the working group. The point I was going to raise was a different one, which is that I think we still have some more work on Category D question 4 to do, and I'd love to see it built into the schedule, and that's because I don't think we've really dealt with some of the concerns raised by the NCSG in its statement about the misuse of the process when alleged malicious conduct is being is an allegation being misused to really harass an organization or find a registrant, and it's language thrown out there because you can do it, but the proxy privacy service provider or others are on notice that this isn't, or have reason to know that this is frivolous or harassing. And, you know, I just think there's more to explore in this very, very important point. So as we're looking at the schedule, I wanted to raise that. Thanks.
Okay, I appreciate it. Well, it is on the D4 is on our agenda for today, and we don't have to necessarily limit ourselves to the to the alternative language that's already been put together. Just a second, excuse me. Okay, sorry about that. We'll get to D4 right after we talk about what's ahead of us. The second part of what's ahead of us in terms of work plan, and have time to talk about some of the practical sides and how they're part of our policy considerations. Any other thoughts on this topic right now? Okay. Let's move on to the next piece. Mary, Marika, Steve, Graham, and I had some discussions in Los Angeles, in London, about a pilot project that ICANN is putting together that involves professional facilitation of face-to-face meetings. And we have been identified as a good group to test the concept with. So as a result, it's been put out there as a possibility for the Los Angeles meeting. Now, as you have seen, I am just back from vacation and still a little fuzzy on everything that I saw in, say, CARES communications and in communications to the general group. So if I could back away and ask Marika just to discuss this, if nothing else, you're much more familiar with the project in general, but also the specifics of where we are and what we and the doodle poll and how we need to proceed. Just to the group, we do have some unexpectedly short time. This could involve funding for travel, at least for a few extra nights or one extra night. And because of new policies from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, we're going to have to deal with those questions much sooner than is normal for travel subsidies to ICANN meetings. Marika?
Yeah, thanks, Don. So this is Marika. So as Don says, this is a pilot project that has been requested by the GNSO Council, partly also inspired by some of the recommendations that were made by the ATRT, to look at what ways would help or facilitate PDP working groups, possibly looking at reducing timelines, also maybe working through difficult discussions, and basically trying to experiment with some features that may facilitate those processes. So one of the suggestions is indeed, one aspect is the face-to-face aspect. Does it really help working groups moving forward, having face-to-face time? And I think most people probably agree that that has tended to work quite well, either as part of an ICANN setting or separately. And then there's also the question of professional facilitation. Does it help bringing in an outsider to facilitate some of the conversations and trying to move forward on some of the topics that working groups are looking at? So as such, the GNSO Council received funding under the special budget request from the ICANN board to test or pilot such a project over fiscal year 15. So the idea is that tagged on to each ICANN meeting, we'll have a one-day face-to-face meeting of a PDP working group, looking at where the different groups are in the timeline. And in this case, for the LA meeting, it looks very timely for Privacy and Proxy Working Group to maybe have that opportunity, as it rightly aligns with the publication of the initial report, which is foreseen for the beginning of next year. So maybe an opportune moment to work through some of the items that we haven't been able to resolve yet. So the proposal is to have a full-day meeting on the Friday, 10th of October, right before the start of the ICANN meeting. And just to correct what Don said, the only thing that is funded under this pilot project is the one-night additional hotel night from the Thursday to the Friday. And the assumption is made, or the hope is, that as part of this project, some of the groups that get allocated travel funding will take that into account as they make their decisions on people being assigned to travel to the meetings. And what is covered under the proposal is that each stakeholder group can assign up to 6 existing working group members to participate in the face-to-face meeting, for whom one additional hotel night would be covered. As I said, no airfare or other travel funding is covered as part of this pilot project. So as such, you know, it is really the hope that stakeholder groups are able to identify either members that are already funded for their travel, either through other means, ICANN funds, or by themselves, and are able to participate. If stakeholder groups are not able to use all of their 6 slots, the working group chairs may decide to allocate the one additional night to another working group member, taking into account the overall balance of participants. And the same also applies to 6 slots for SOAC or individual working group members that also have been foreseen to participate. Although if there are groups that have more than 6 people that don't need additional funding, of course, the meeting is open and will also have remote participation. I think it's very important as well to emphasize that, of course, anything coming out of that meeting, will be going back to the mailing list, and we'll make sure as well that if people are not able to attend, no decisions are taken there that can be undone or not vetted through the broader group. I think very important as well to highlight this is really a pilot, and we hope to learn from this and at the end of the fiscal year make an assessment on whether this works, it doesn't work, what are areas for improvement, what was the experience of people, did it help indeed in the overall timeline of the PDP to reduce that, did it help working groups to work through complex issues that may have been harder to do via conference calls or mailing lists. So again, this is really an experiment, and the idea is that following this call, we'll send you an email with further information and also an initial doodle poll just to already assess whether people are actually available, noting that in certain cases it may really depend on whether you'll have the means to actually come to the LA meeting, but we just want to see if there's at least an indication or interest to participate in such a meeting. So we're planning to send it out shortly after the meeting, and then hopefully you'll be able to respond to that as well. Just one note of caution here as well. We've been told that for this specific meeting, the information on funded travelers, which is, as I said, separate from this pilot project, which goes through each of the stakeholder groups and constituencies, has a much shorter timeline than some of the previous meetings. So that is well the reason why we wanted to flag this so early, so that all the stakeholder groups and constituencies are aware that this meeting is being planned, and hopefully that can be factored into any discussions or decisions that are being made in relation to funding that is assigned to people to travel to the meeting. So I think that's it in a snapshot. There's also a more detailed proposal that we shared with the council that the council reviewed over the weekend, in which we've outlined a little bit the proposed approach. Of course, we'll closely look as well at the work plan and work closely with the chairs as well as the facilitator to plan for the actual day, because, of course, the real objective is as well to make as much use of that time as possible and, of course, as well share that with the group so everyone is part as well of those conversations, and it's really a collaborative effort, hopefully. So I think that's all the information I had to share at this stage. As I said, we'll be sending out an email shortly after this call with further information as well as a doodle poll, and hopefully many of you will be able to participate in the poll as well as the meeting itself in LA.
Thanks. Appreciate the description. Clearly I was fogged enough that I got at least one piece wrong. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metallis. Just 2 questions, and some of this may be answered in the material you'll be sending out, but you refer to an additional hotel night. But in fact, I mean, if you look at the people who are participating in this working group from my stakeholder group, very few of them are likely to be, I don't know for sure, but there may not be overlap. There may not be much overlap between the travelers who receive assistance or otherwise receive assistance to come to an ICANN meeting and those who are participating on this working group. So if someone is not receiving any travel support, are you saying that they would get one night of travel support if they attended this meeting and if they were on the list submitted by the stakeholder group? That's my first question. And my second question, which may be, you know, because of the accelerated timetable here, I guess the question is, by when do we have to make the go or no-go decision on this? Thank you.
This is Marika. On the hotel night, indeed, the assumption was that it would be mainly people that would already be funded by ICANN Travel Fund to come to the meeting. And for those,
I'm telling you,
Marika,
that assumption is not
valid. Yes, exactly. So that may be something we need back as part of the, you know, and evaluation of the pilot project. However, you know, we do have basically the budget is based on a number of hotel nights. So indeed, if we do see that, you know, there are hotel nights left or we have less people able to participate, we can, of course, decide to reallocate that. And I think that's a discussion that the chairs may want to have, looking at, you know, the application received and making sure as well that there's a, you know, I think, a reasonable balance between the different groups. So I think from that perspective, there is flexibility, but there is, you know, a cap of on the number of hotel nights that we have been granted.
Okay, and then do we, or maybe this will be in what you send out, what is kind of the date for making a go or no-go decision on doing this in-person meeting?
Basically, I think we're operating on the assumption that it is a go unless, you know, we get indications based on a doodle poll that no one is able or interested to come. I think that's a bit the assumption we're operating under at this stage, at least from my perspective.
Okay, thank you. I think this is useful information. I see there's a lot of objection in the chat to having this discussion. I'm not sure why, but I think it's helpful to have the rest of these details. Thank you.
Okay. I think we did need to at least throw the possibility out there and, again, give people time to ask questions. If there aren't any.
This is the operator.
Hello?
We'll try to isolate that line.
Yep. Hi. Back.
Okay. this is kind of a fairly important thing for the working group, and I think it was necessary to at least throw it out on the call. If there are no more questions, they need to be answered now. We'll move it over to email and a doodle poll and move on to category D, question 4. I'm just waiting here. We've had a bit of back and forth on the whole issue of types of abuse. We've talked about reporting forms. There have been a few suggested edits to the last version that we looked at, with quite a few, I think, back and forth that never even got to. Got to the document. But I'd like to move ahead here and sorry, had to break again. Try to wrap up D4 today. We still, looking at the prepared text, I think we have some issues concerning the concept of a standardized reporting form. To be honest, I think part of the issues are what should be in it, but even a threshold issue is the extent to which we're maybe going a little bit past our scope and into the operational details. But also, Kathy had some additional issues she wanted to, or maybe old issues that she wanted to address more closely. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metallitz. Looking down to the end of this document that's posted here and the preliminary conclusions, I see we have three versions, and I'm trying to understand the differences among these three versions. As far as I can tell, the only difference between what's listed as working group preliminary conclusion and what's listed as Don's suggestion is that Don drops the word indicative from the statement that there should be an indicative list of forms of conduct that would need to be covered, and you've dropped indicative. So I guess my first question, is that the only difference there? And then the second, on the point about the let me go on with the second point, which is those two versions make some reference to a starting point for such a form could be that used under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the United States. I'm not quite sure where I don't remember how that got, you know, who proposed that sentence, but in fact there isn't really a single form under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. There's a list of minimum list of information or data that has to be included in a DMCA notice, and there is some work underway right now to try to standardize forms, but there isn't really a standardized form today. So I just wanted to say that if we go with that language, we may need to modify it to say that a starting point could be the information required under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act or something like that, because there isn't really a standardized form. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll answer at least a part addressed to me. I dropped the word indicative, but I also added another alternative as a reporting form. To be honest, as I suggested a minute ago, I'm not sure that level of detail is even appropriate for what we write, but I'm tossing that out for consideration. The DMC possibility was discussed on at least one phone call, and as a result, brought into the text for preliminary conclusion. Appreciate the note about there is no form. I'm not that familiar with it, and nobody else raised that point at the time it was being discussed online. Kathy?
Sure, although I did ask for the form to be circulated if someone had it, and no one circulated it. So I love Steve's idea of maybe crossing out the DMCA language because a lot of questions have been raised about it. Thanks. I wanted to raise three questions about this section, Category D, Question 4. One is, what is the underlying purpose of the question? Is it to identify conduct, or is it also to identify more information about the questioner? Which leads to my second question, which is, how do we protect, and this is something the non-commercial stakeholder group statement raised, which is, how do we protect against fraudulent complaints, harassing complaints, misleading complaints, and frivolous complaints? I'd love to know more from the proxy privacy providers. But I've heard stories that there are providers who can identify, you know, which attorneys are coming in for legitimate purposes versus illegitimate purposes, and others as well. And so how do we incorporate that kind of information into our discussion of this matter? And then the third thing, as I look at this question overall, is that we are applying standards from the new GTLDs to the existing GTLDs, and I wanted to know if that was being done purposely or kind of unintentionally. What we see is references and footnotes to Safeguard 2, Annex 1 of GAC's Beijing Communique, which states a more explicit or wider area of abuse. And we're kind of applying it to everything, to existing GTLDs as well, without really flagging that this was something that was written for and intended for new GTLDs. Do we really want to expand it to existing GTLDs? And I just thought, I wasn't sure if that conversation had been had before we kind of adopt it. But one thing I'd really like is for staff, if they could, to flag footnotes that this is language for new GTLDs. that when we look at revisions to the registrar agreement, this is specifically for new GTLDs, not existing GTLDs. So thanks. Those were the three things: the larger purpose of the question, how we protect against questioners who may not have the best of motives, and this kind of existing GTLD, new GTLD question. Thanks, Son. Sorry to give this in our post-holiday period.
Okay. Thanks. I'll just move on. Holly?
Yeah, I have. First of all, I would agree with Kathy. I think we should basically drop the language of the American Copyright Act, since that particular provisions in there simply don't apply in probably most of the rest of the world. Certainly not in Australia, so it wouldn't make sense here. But I also have a question in terms of, are we differentiating between a request for information from, say, law enforcement, which will involve criminality and probably prompt response and probably through established law enforcement agencies, as opposed to any other request which is legitimate or not legitimate, because I think certainly from what I've heard from some people, if the request for information is from a law enforcement agency and it's verified and it goes through the right channels, there will be a pretty prompt response. What we don't understand is the response that will be for other requests, legitimate or otherwise, and perhaps we need to treat those in different ways. Thanks.
Holly, let me just ask you for a clarification. When you're referring to a request from law enforcement, are you thinking about a compulsory document or just your...
What I'm suggesting is there will be instances where a recognized law enforcement agency has detected essentially potential criminal activity or activity that they want immediate takedown. I mean, it's a clear criminality issue, which is most registrars would respond to immediately, as opposed to other quite legitimate requests for information, perhaps from corporate regulators, from IP people, from lawyers, from whomever, not the law enforcement agency, but nevertheless a legitimate request for information. Obviously, they're going to be, well, my understanding from conversations in the past, they will be dealt with differently. I hope that clarifies that.
It does, but let me just suggest, as somebody who's heavily into the topic for PIR, I'm not sure it's accurate to say that we would react to a law enforcement inquiry different from anybody else if it wasn't a warrant or a court order. If it was just a please take it down or please give us this information, I wouldn't assume that we would act on that.
No, I was referring to, say, a court order or a warrant where, in fact, there would be a response as opposed to a request.
Okay. Well, in that case, then we are on the same page. Wasn't completely sure there. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metalitz. Going back to Kathy's questions, first, as to the, I think if we go back and look at the question here, it is what are the forms of alleged malicious conduct, if any, that would be covered? It doesn't really get into who's making the request. My sense is that that's, I mean, going back and looking at the responses that my constituency made on these questions back in March, I think that's best dealt with under relay and reveal, because then that's where you might get into, you know, you might not respond to a frivolous request or request that's illegitimate. I mean, I'd be happy to consider what language you would want to suggest here, but I think it probably fits better in categories E and F. Second, on your point about we're not importing new GTLD standards into this. We're using a list that appears in the GAC communique and in the public interest commitments as an indicative list of the kinds of conduct. Again, that's what the question is about, the kinds of conduct that are involved. If you have a better list or another source that could be used for this, I think we should include it. But it isn't imposing any it's not treating all these the same as new GTLDs. You know, there is language in the Registrar Accreditation Agreement that addresses some of this, but it seemed like the list of that was in the PIC commitment number 3 and in the GAC communique, Beijing communique, as applicable to all new GTLDs, was a good list to use as a starting point for this indicative list. And finally, to Holly's question, again, I think this question is about what kinds of conduct are covered, what kinds of alleged misbehavior, rather than who's requesting it. But clearly, this would apply both to law enforcement requests and non-law enforcement requests. So, you know, they could come from either source, I suppose. Thank you.
Let me just inject, although any list we come up with is irrelevant, if I get a court order directed at public interest registry, whatever we've got in this list, and of course we wouldn't be a proxy privacy provider, but the point is anything we come up with is going to be irrelevant if we get a court order saying, do it. McKaylee?
Thanks, Don. McKaylee Nalen for the record. Okay, it's been quite a few people in there since I kind of first put my hand up, so I'm going to kind of go backwards a little bit. With respect to the court order point, we will respond to court orders if they come from outside the Irish jurisdiction, but we're not going to act on them. So, I mean, I'd be careful about saying that everybody's going to act on a court order. If I send PIR a court order issued by the court here in Carlow, I sincerely doubt that PIR would act on it. I mean, you might respond to it, but I can't see you acting. With going back to this entire thing around the DMCA thing, from my recollection on the conversation around this, I think what we were trying to do was to come up with some kind of standardized reporting format or form or something. I mean, in other words, the elements that would be required in order for an abuse report of some kind to be actionable, I suppose, in some respect. I mean, for example, if somebody sends in an abuse report to us saying that there's an issue with a server, but they don't specify which server, it makes it very hard for us to do anything. I mean, in fact, it renders it completely impossible. Or somebody sends in some other kind of vague thing, you know, you can't really act on that kind of report. You need detail to be able to do something with it, even if it is simply to say it's out of scope for you to handle it. I think that's where that entire thing with the DMCA thing came from. I'd agree with others. I mean, the DMCA isn't probably the best thing to base anything off, but if there had been some kind of standardized form, it would have done nicely as a starting point. What else? There was quite a few other things that came through there, but I think I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thanks. You anticipated some things I was considering there. Stephanie?
Yes, hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hello?
Yep.
Working? Okay.
Yep, yeah. No, we can't hear you. Stephanie? Is anybody else hearing Stephanie?
I think we lost her.
No.
Okay.
She has gone AWOL.
Okay. Well, hopefully she'll come back in. Are there any other comments on this point, or on D4 in general? Okay, well, pending Stephanie jumping back in, Kathy?
Yeah. Great. Don, if we are talking about forms here, what type of information, let me throw it out to everyone, if I might, what type of information would be useful to know from the questioner? And maybe it's more than who they are, but also some basis for the request. I know we're not going through a full evidentiary hearing here, but how do people differentiate a frivolous request from a legitimate request? Let's exclude law enforcement at this point and go to Holly's point of the non-law enforcement request. I think this is a really important question, so thanks.
Well, we do have the APWG form that people should have received, and I think a question I'll toss back is the issue who, and I think Stephanie suggested this in text, is the issue who versus what?
But Don, can I add that with the APWG, some of it is more, can be more independently verified when we're talking about malware or spam. Here, we're running, given the list of issues that we're looking at, we're running to content issues. And a lot of that is in the eye of the beholder. Is it a copyright infringement or is it fair use? Is it trademark? Versus APWG, which in general, and correct me if I'm wrong, I found is more subject to independent verification. Malware. You can check that. Botnets. There are ways to affirm this, even independently.
All right. I'll move on to McHale in a second. That's true, but that's still, and again, APWG is just a list of items we can play with if we get into specifying. But still, it's an issue of, because it's a trademark, doesn't necessarily mean it's a frivolous. So I'm not sure that identifying by submitter or subject is going to be conclusive. McHale?
Thanks, Don McHale, for the transcript. Just to address some of Kathy's points, and probably not all of them, I mean, from our perspective as a hosting provider and registrar, the kind of things that we would need for an abuse report of any kind in order to be able to do anything useful with it would be the domain name, preferably the full URL to the abuse, whatever, a clear identification of what the abuse is, be that malware, phishing, or something else. I mean, in the cases of copyright type things, I mean, we've seen people trying to use all sorts of interesting copyright claims, which aren't simply a case of person X is providing movies for download or something, which we can actually understand. But things like, you know, person X is using some of my software without a license, and, you know, it's something which is really, really, really messy and hard to understand. But the thing we get a lot of, unfortunately, is completely useless kind of complaints, where it's like, you know, you are hosting a website that insults me. Full stop. But they don't actually tell you which website it is. They don't tell you which domain name it is or anything else. So that becomes quite hard to deal with. I'm sure there are other people on the call who would have more experience of different types of requests. To date, I think we've only received one complaint of sorts, which was more of an inquiry from a consumer protection authority, which was the Irish Consumer Protection Authority. Which was, I can't even remember what it was about. It wasn't a big deal anyway. But we do get quite a few, the ones where even if they have a genuine complaint, it becomes quite hard to decipher it. And assuming that any registrar or their staff is particularly interested in a whole load of stuff to do with a particular company's marks and stuff like that is kind of weird. I mean, they put what causes most delays for us is that the business part of us, the bit that we actually care about, the type of abuse, isn't clearly identified towards the top of the report. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks. To be honest, I think, well, no. Never mind that. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metallitz. I think the items McKaylee lists, I mean, is interesting because that actually pretty closely parallels what would be required for a DMCA notice, you know, to give the domain name or the URL and clearly identify what it is that you claim to be the abuse and so forth. So, again, I don't think there's any need to reference the DMCA, but it could be that the types of information that are required for that notice is useful in this context. This question focuses on the types of abuse. Then this is a proxy or privacy service provider. So you receive a complaint. What are you being asked to do is really the question, isn't it? I mean, one thing you might be asked to do is to relay it. One thing you might be asked to do is to reveal to the complainant who the actual registrant is. One thing I suppose you might be asked to do is to kick the registrant out of your program for violating terms of service and thereby make that information available to the public in general. I'm not sure what else there would be that would be the thrust of the request. So when we get to relay and reveal, we should talk about, you know, what is the method for screening out or what exactly should be required in this notice. But I'm not clear that for a proxy or privacy service provider there's anything else other than relay, reveal, or publish, if you will, that would be required. This is not a case where you're being asked to take, you know, to cancel the registration, because proxy service providers don't make registrations. So, you know, at least they're not registrars. So, and it's not a question where you're being asked to take down anything. It's a situation where you may be asked to relay or reveal. So let's just keep that in context when we discuss this. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Any other comments? Stephanie, we've got about 2 minutes. If you can come in, your text testing is working, or your chat testing is working. Hello? Okay, we do have just 2 minutes left. Are there any other comments? Clearly, there's no point in opening up Category E, question one at this point. Is there any other comments people want to raise concerning these issues or anything else that we... that we've talked about today? Now that I've vamped, I'm down to 1 minute. Kathy?
Hi, Dad. Just real fast, I think we're talking about some new fields in the chat room areas. And so, you know, just slightly expanded fields that may help us as we go into reveal and relay. So I look forward to the updated version and appreciate the discussion today.
Okay.
And want to know more about the secret agreement between McKaylee and Steve.
Totally confidential.
It's secret. It's confidential, for God's sake.
Are we allowed to do that on a DNSO working group?
Only if laughing.
It's not in breach of any guidelines.
Okay. Stephanie, I just heard your voice, but we just hit 11 o'clock, or the end of the call, wherever you happen to be. So if you could send it out in email or whatever, I'd appreciate it. Sorry about the follow-up. Wherever it was, or Sorry about the follow-up. That's a good way to put it. It wasn't, probably wasn't on Adobe's end, or ICANN's end, or I'm going into post-travel babbling, aren't I? Why don't we... I'm sorry. I just saw Marika's hand there.
Yeah, this is Marika. I just need 10 seconds just to know that we do have a template ready for question one, in which we've tried to gather as much information as we can on the relay questions that come up in that, and we'll get that out after the call so people can already start thinking as well ahead of the next meeting. Is there any other information that should be included there as background information, either from studies or other reports that have been produced by ICANN or other groups, so that we can start the conversation possibly next week on that topic. That's all.
Excellent. Thanks. And with that, why don't we wrap today's call and talk to you all next week.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.